And we have plenty of examples of that. Mm-hmm. So the only legitimacy of the Senate is as a limitation on the otherwise unlimited power of the government of the day, which usually means the Prime Minister of the day. And we can change it in all sorts of ways. We can think of all sorts of better breaks on total power of megalomaniac prime ministers. But we should be careful about abandoning one safeguard until we're pretty sure we've got others of equal, at least equal effectiveness in place. And I think the role of the two houses always has to be considered on the basis of that situation. So I have kept to my time, Mr. Chairman. Within the time, in fact.
Well, you're not a senator.
Welcome the discussion that might follow. Thank you.
Coming from a place where in the Senate filibusters are the norm, I'm really very impressed at the self-restraint we've had exercised. We have a brief period of time, so I hope that we will have some questions from those of you who are attending, or perhaps comments from members of the panel about what they have heard. Yes, sir. Please come to the mic.
I agree that with Senator Baum or former Senator Baum, that any upper house is better than none. You cited Queensland, but I think we should see that where you've got a majoritarian Westminster system, you will not succeed for the reasons that Harry Evans has expounded. And we've got a couple of good examples internationally in Northern Ireland and New Zealand, both of whom could not make a unicameral single chamber work. I think it's quite important, sort of basic situation in political science, a pragmatic position. Around the world, according to Leipart, you've got 11 democracies where you've got a unicameral PR, but you know, your unicameral majoritarian, you only had pre-1996 New Zealand, and of course the catastrophe of Northern Ireland from about 1920 to 1970, I suppose, where that just does not work. And I suppose that it works in Queensland and in the Northern Territory with us because they are actually sub-polities, and that's the only reason they work at all. They're prevented from going totally bananas by the federal polity. So the Clark's comments about the security provided by that upper house is vital. The other thing is that I would agree with you is that the lower house is theatre. I'd see no point in the lower house. I mean, why bother? Why bother having sittings? Sittings could be abandoned. The clerk of the lower house could have a rubber stamp saying passed. It would save us such a lot of money. And I mean, apart from the political point made of the upper house passing some legislation that they know the lower house isn't going to pass, and that, generally speaking, the lower house is obedient to the upper house, isn't it? The Senate, I mean. So there's not a lot of point. I mean, the lower house passes whatever the government wants, gets the upper house, there's a lot of argy-bargy, amendments are made, comes back to the lower house obeys. That's a general situation.
Can I respond to that by saying, how do you connect the constituencies that voted for those members in the House of Reps with that particular mandate, and unless you've kind of got that activity that's there? That government won't get elected to deliver that unless you've got that connection between the members and their constituency. So unless you have that activity or that theatre, then it doesn't work.
Well, you may say so, but I don't think that 99.9% of the population takes the slightest notice of what goes on in the lower house. And when they do take notice, they take notice of Question Time, which is pure theatre, and it's not connected to their particular member anyway. Where they are connected to their member is in the electorate office, and the lower house members typically, generally, much prefer to be back there in the electorate where they are connected.
That they do, but they still need that process to connect them to that larger debate. I mean, it doesn't happen by osmosis. You've got to be here and be participating and be exchanging those ideas with the Cabinet and the backbench in order to facilitate that.
Yes, if I could add to that, you and I have a disconnect, and it's not just because I couldn't hear you properly, and that is the best debates exist in the Parliament building, within the party rooms where decisions are made. And it's the members of Parliament who in their party rooms discuss in brief and significant addresses the issues. Now, the fact is, apart from those members of the parties who like to leak them to the media, those debates where you are aiming at convincing your colleagues are the meaningful debates about legislation.
Yes.
And the outcome, when I talked about theatre, it's the outcome of those debates which are essential. It's the outcome of those debates which are then, if you like, reproduced on the floor of the chamber for the purpose of informing the public what the case is for and the case against. But until the case is determined in the party rooms, your suggestion, well, what's the point? The point is that the attitudes are then created in the party rooms. The government comes in with a proposal, it goes to the backbench committee discusses it, and then it is ultimately, I think the Labor Party, I think, has formal votes. The coalition tends to support the concept of theoretical consensus. And when Malcolm was Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser was Prime Minister, consensus would often be 1 to 13 carried. But basically, if you don't have that debate by the members,
well, I haven't got anything.
You don't have an issue.
I haven't got anything against the party room having a debate. In fact, that would be a great debate to hear, but it's not the debate we get in the lower house where the parties toe the party line. They may, in their caucus or party room, get up and speak their minds.
Well, that's a democratic process.
I hope they do, but they certainly don't do that in the lower house. They toe the party line, so that's not...
I don't contest that. I just think the point is that it's not a pointless exercise. It's part of building the mandate for what a government is doing.
I think Harry wanted in on this conversation too.
Yeah. Well, an observation I've often wanted to make. When government makes a bad decision, which turns out to be a bad decision, it's impossible to find a government backbencher who supported it in the party room. But invariably say, I didn't support that and I argued against it, but the PM wanted to do that and I knew it was wrong, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a disconnect, I think. And the disconnect is, of course, that if the debate doesn't take place in public, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah, but the reality
but that
is you have to have the debate.
Doesn't take place in public. You just said so.
Sorry,
but that debate doesn't take place in public.
That's what I said. The party room debate doesn't take place in public. So
that's right. So the public.
You're missing the essential point. When you say they follow the party line, how the hell do you think the party line is developed?
Well,
by osmosis?
No.
It's developed by debate. Now, the fact that
that's
you
fine.
Are not necessarily party to that debate, and I say not necessarily, because in fact there are so many leakers out of the party room that you generally do become aware of what the case for and against is. So, I mean, apart from that, your argument falls down on that ground. But the essential point is, by simply parroting the proposition that people just follow the party line, how is the party line developed? Yeah, and that's the issue.
Well, the party room can have its debate before any legislation can go to the lower house, to my hypothetical clerk's rubber stamp saying passed. You would have to have your debate. I've got nothing against your debate. I'm in favour of your debate. I'm in favour of a genuine debate, that's all.
It's an essential
I'm saying.
Part of the process.
Yes,
that's the point I'm making to you. And you're suggesting the process is a farce.
The performance
and I'm
in
saying,
the house
no, it's not.
Irrelevant.
It's meaningful.
Well, according to all those government backbenches that I've mentioned, the party line was developed because the boss wanted it. We didn't really want to do that, but the boss wanted it.
Well, exactly. So, you know, let them have their debate. I'm sure that some of those debates are valid. But anyway, whatever goes to the lower house is going to get passed, basically.
Can
so
I give
why
you
bother
example?
With it?
Can I give you an example of what happens in the party room? Shortly after...
Hang on, we keep going around this point. The party room's fine. Let them have their debate.
If you would let me speak, you'd probably understand why I'm making the point. I'm making the point that shortly after Fraser was elected with a massive majority, he had as his ambition cutting of government expenditure, slashing it. He went to the party room with a proposal that the funeral benefit be suspended. The funeral benefit was costing, I think, about $2.2 million a year, of which over $1 million was administrative expenses. But let's face it, there were pensioners who were incipient corpses tended to take the view that this was a terrible thing to do. There was a debate in the party room about it, for and against. I was against it. I had a marginal seat. That had nothing to do with it. And I had a lot of people who were incipient corpses, and in particular there was about to be a New South Wales election where the two key seats were Gosford and the Blue Mountains, both of them chock-a-block full of incipient corpses. Now, the big question is the party room debated it. The party room debate ended up overwhelmingly opposed to what Fraser wanted to do. Fraser nonetheless said, well, I'm going to do it because otherwise our rhetoric about cutting government expenditure is ridiculous. I pointed out to the party room that one of the great benefits of the funeral benefit was that it advised, when people applied for the funeral benefit, it was early advice to the Department of Social Security to stop sending out pension checks. In other words, it had a massive administrative benefit, which the government had not told the party room. As a result of that discussion, 8 senators took the view that the party room view should be reflected in the parliament. They voted against it in the upper house. Now, there are a whole lot of consequences of that. One of them was that Fraser then became very cautious about cutting government expenditure. But the point I want to make to you is that party room discussions create the situation which is reflected one way or another on the floor of the parliament. And it is not acceptable to me for you to keep parroting the party line without recognising that the democratic process involves the creation of that, quotes, party line. It is part of the process, an essential part of the process. And in fact, in my view, it's a shame that a lot of the essences of the debates within the party room do get partly leaked by people with particular self-interest. Because in my view, there is a greater prospect of the party room coming to a sensible decision if there is confidentiality.
And here I was wondering, as the presentations went on, how we were going to provoke some controversy and some discussion. At this point, we have two options, one of which is to continue this exchange, the other of which is lunch. I propose lunch without objection, as we say, so ordered. John, Rachel, any directions? No. Then I presume in the ante room where we had our coffee earlier, you will find some lunch. Please indulge and please be back at 12:30 so we can resume the afternoon program. 1:30. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Jen.
Got more faces to do. Oh. On here, he's got something called ANU bicameralism power. And he's doing it. He's on it.
That's good.
Oh, sorry.
What's that? No, no.
Now, what do you want? Is made available now. He's on 330. So I said,
So
you can take that.
Yeah.
And when you printed it out,
Now, Lynn, I've been given a little bit of blurb about you, which John's pulled off.
I don't know why.
I suppose we're ready to go. Okay, it's past 1:30, so we might as well resume. We're looking in this session at state innovations in bicameralism. It occurred to me this morning when we were getting our potted history lessons about the Senate and its origins that, you know, the story about bits taken from Washington and Westminster, that there's a third part of this story that my colleague Campbell Sharman's written about in the past, and that should be essential reading for everybody who wants to talk about the antecedents of the Senate, and that is that that all Australian jurisdictions prior to the creation of the Commonwealth had bicameral parliaments. And even if Australia hadn't been a federation, it would have looked highly anomalous for the Commonwealth Parliament to be set up in unicameral form. So one of the major reasons why the Parliament of the Commonwealth is bicameral is that it is part of an Australian tradition of bicameralism that reaches back into colonial times, back into the 19th century.